Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Susan B. Anthony Summers Willett, which is a lot of names. I have to say that again.
It is. Blame my mother and father.
Okay. Susan B. Anthony Summers Willett was raised in New Orleans. Her first book of poetry, Rome, was published in 2006 as part of the Crab Orchard Award series. Her poems have appeared in Virginia Quarterly Review, Painted Bride Quarterly, and Hayden's Fairy Review. And she was recently selected by Poets and Writers magazine as one of the debut poets who made their mark in 2006. A member of three national poetry slam teams, Susan recently moved to Pittsburgh to be a visiting scholar with the Center for the Arts and Society at Carnegie Mellon University. So welcome to Pittsburgh.
Well, thank you. I love it here.
All right. Great. We can talk about that in a minute, but we better get to your poetry.
So. Okay.
Rome is the name of your book.
Yes. And I'm going to start just with the first poem in that book, Self-Portrait as Interstate 10, which is about growing up along and near Interstate 10. Self-Portrait as Interstate 10. Still, the sky is the great equalizer. Still, I yawn into the visible, yellow sun, shack, mountains of uncertain range. What gives life are two directions, to and away like a decisive heart. The saguaros wave in the way of surrendering bankers. What is it to be a sign, a coffee cup, the grave of a doll's discarded leg? I end, I begin. I have known death and have doubled back. I am the last gas station on its three stilts rising out of the sea, or the child born there. To hear the ocotillo burst into white laughter after rain. To be the keeper of distances, defined by landscape and trash. To the foal of cows in spring, and the crossing corpses of Texas, I say, come unto me. Leave. Here, a cross marks the earth where three sisters have buried their animal. Here, the dung of a beast grows sweet to dry in the sun. To know not night, but the fading of a lamp. To live the constant gray of a bayou. And here, in L.A., here in Florida, here in Lake Charles, towers of sulfur flicker and that hell singes its lit eyes against the good white clouds. Here swamp, bay, monument, tin can with a mouth ragged as a southern woman, and I am her spine pressed to the bedsheet. There is no home, only postcards. No relationship unmarked by distance. Of all things, I am the same photograph taken at different times of day. Me, the lyric of truck tires in a deluge, or me, those years of dark water in a plant's heart, or me, that small animal blooming in a hawk's fist, not drowning, not waving, but falling out of the sky. The next poem that I'll read is about my mother and her mother. It's called Stella Stella, and Stella is my grandmother's name, and it's about her and our relationships with each other. Stella Stella. As if the golden wires shared by women would throw off sparks. We worry rocks, stalk our mother's bedrooms. We wipe the shine on with a cloth. I've asked my mother's rings and watches and faded jewelry boxes for some past I could not name in its long and awkward birth. At the kitchen table, she strings winking necklaces of onyx and quartz, minerals pressed for answers. Not that she doesn't love her mother, but that a dread lives there. Our women married early, got pregnant soon, and tied their jewelry in skirts to spite the night's moving. When they slept lightly, listening for the child's cough. Kept journals they later threw with their husbands or threw away. At 7, I fingered a silver cross I bought without permission. At 19, I listened to the glissando of widows' fingers across whalebone chains, their pendants lost. They buried their husbands in the way they knew how. My mother became the terror of a garnet lost in the sheets, and then the dull glow of a cameo, angel skin cheeks in bas relief. As if our wishes for the other would not soften or bend. When she left her mother, it was to Lisbon and Saudi Arabia and short phone calls made from long distances she pronounced in native tongues. Now Stella's breath becomes a filigree on the telephone, my mother's voice filling the gaps. We know that like cops, death clocks the nearest shining thing. I imagine my mother coming home and liberating prize china to the wall, or smashing a cookie in her mouth, or trying perfume from the law of Victorian bottles arranged on her mother's vanity. As if what we take with us could be weighed by its dancing in the light. Walk silent, night. These are women who pledged their daughters diamonds. Yes, notice their edges.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Susan B. Anthony Summers Willett, reading from her new book entitled Rome, published by Southern Illinois University Press. Okay, I want to ask you about issues of home and distance, which it's almost like whatever poem you're reading, that's what keeps coming up to me.
Mm-hmm.
Are those part of your obsessions and part of what made this book?
Yeah, I don't know if it's part of my obsession. It certainly is a major theme of the book, the sort of rootlessness and sense of homelessness that I had after my father died of cancer about 14 years ago. And at that time, my family moved from New Orleans. My father died. My mother moved to Little Rock, and she moved into a place that, you know, I didn't have my own room or anything. There was no designated space for me. So I really did feel I not only lost my hometown, but I lost my home. And although, you know, home, of course, is where you make it, there was still that very concrete sense of loss at a very formative time for me. I was 19. So, and that's actually when I started writing poetry. So this book is very much centered around those feelings of rootlessness and homelessness and the search for that sort of sense of home and knowing that you can never quite return to it.
Mm-hmm. And yet, I guess there's a very strong sense of place in the book too.
Mm.
I mean, in relation to New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And so somehow that relates to this home and distance. And can you talk a little about New Orleans and how it relates to the rhythms in your work and your work as a slam poet also?
Yeah. Well, I think that New Orleans culture is music culture. So I think that the sort of cadence of New Orleanian language, of slang, of the very music itself, of blues and jazz, is very influential. Although I wouldn't necessarily characterize myself as a blues poet, I am very interested in the prosody of language, in the musicality of language. And that's something that's actually informed as well as my, with my experience in the slam poetry community. That's a community I've been involved with for the last decade or so. And having competed on national poetry slam teams and also, having completed critical scholarship about it. It's interesting to see how a poem works on the stage as opposed to how it works on the page. And I found that participating in both those venues, both on the page and the stage, that the performance of or the performativity of slam has really informed how I write, how I compose on the page, because I'm more invested in how the poem sounds and the music of the poem.
Okay, but wait a minute, because I think all poets, I mean, all really strong, good poets are concerned with the music of the line and how poems sound. So how is this different?
Well, I think it's just that I'm willing to pay a little bit more attention to it. I mean, you'll see on the slam stage, you'll see rhyme and meter used unabashedly, especially those poets who are coming from a hip hop tradition. There is sort of more a kind of emphasis on the formal aspects of language, although they might not consciously be using it that way. So I think that, not that other poets who are working on the page don't pay attention to music, but that having to perform the verse and having it in my mouth mm-hmm. really makes me pay attention to it mm-hmm. much more and has actually influenced how I compose.
Okay. How about more poems?
Okay, great. Well, you mentioned New Orleans. I think I'll read a poem about New Orleans called Notes for Living in NOLA, which is New Orleans, Louisiana, the abbreviation for it. And for your listeners who may not be familiar with New Orleans or New Orleans culture, in the poem I make reference to a jazz man in a park named after that jazz man. That's Louis Armstrong, who is famous for his song Mac the Knife. And then I also make reference to two Mardi Gras parades, Zulu and Rex. Zulu is a traditionally black parade. Rex is a traditionally white parade, and they follow each other on Mardi Gras morning. And then finally, I'll say that this poem was written before Hurricane Katrina, but has taken special significance since then. Notes for Living in NOLA. Learn to hate the tourists who booze up, who cruise the one ways the wrong way and ask for the Café du Monde, the Jacks, the Cat's Meow, the Preservation Hall. On Bourbon Street they fall for, I bet you a dollar I can tell where you got those shoes. Sleep till noon, your belly deep and soft. Deal cards and convince others you once shot the moon. Stay above water. Throw parties when there is weather. Vacation during Mardi Gras or do Mardi Gras every other day. Practice the aesthetics of getting out of bed, chasing the cat, the beauty in wavy views of traffic. Note the poetics of a shirt stuck to your back. Baby, you in jazz land, but don't show the blue notes, the thin ropes of hate and self-hate that hold the place together. That cable the soft banks, that sing red cypress, black wire. Here, murder walks slowly, demands you hand over your wallet and things. Don't make no fuss, and perhaps he might pass or ax you out for a beer. Cultivate a dull eye like the black boys on Bourbon who slide and clack for change, who tap-tap parabolas, who tack bottle caps on their Nikes to jump back to where someone said they from. Acclimate to the smell of exhaust and the canal. Pick up the perpetual gifts of beads and cups that wash onto your lawn year long. Eat the food you are most afraid of. Don't drink the water. Learn to hate the tourists who rip Mammy's face off the sweet, sweet pralines that mark their journey south, who buy posters of the jazz man whose pearly teeth match the whites of his Mac the Knife eyes, but never go into the park named after this man. It is dangerous. Perhaps you will die by that knife. Find people to love who tell you suspicious histories. Wash dishes and know there is no end to roaches. celebrate obscure holidays, and master riding a bicycle with a buzz. And this, daily rain at 4, torn green fans of saw palmetto rapping at the screen, steam moving from your shoes, the slip of a cool bottle in hand, you grip it just before losing it. Wake up early for Zulu, leave before Rex. Regret has moved to some other country, so dress, make bets, burn, do nothing. Get on a bus named Cemeteries. These cemeteries are beautiful things. I think in that vein, I will read another poem called Amanita verrosa, which is the scientific name of a very poisonous mushroom that looks very much like the mushroom that we buy in the grocery store. It's a white mushroom. And its nickname is the Destroying Angel. Amanita verrosa. Did you travel by the small river that was our street? Did you hide in the garden waiting for hard rain? Are you the knuckles of some immigrant hand? Or are you the fruit of neglect? Did you fall from the sky? 4 days after the hurricane, you rise from the hot, rotten floorboards of our good neighbor's house. Your tenuous veils lift from under the caps. Your waxy cups shine deadly in full sun. Part of me believes you were born on an island exotic. Part of me believes you first bloomed from my father's mouth. You spread your cool wings on the remnants of house. And when you grow heavy, you will drop. And when you grow heavy, you will release your terrible copies. Your white name will tumor in our yard in the moonlight. For years, I will dig out your angry buttons. For years, I will hold back the hungry dog. For years, I will pull your tender bodies up as you awfully push through the leaf brush. I live here knowing there is poison in the wood, knowing there was always poison in the wood. Overnight, you rise up all over the broken city. You resurrect in numbers and are most certainly destroying angels. I treasure your weird fruit for hours, singing your brief, moist hearts.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Susan B. Anthony Summers Willett. I have to ask you about the name.
Sure.
Susan B. Anthony Summers Willett.
Yeah, it's my full birth name. And I sort of go by the whole thing because I figured my parents named me that for a reason. So I might as well use the whole thing. Actually, I published under Susan B.A. Summers Willett. So I, you know, give the publisher at least a little bit of a break. Mm-hmm. But Summers is my mother's maiden name and Will is my father's name. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of one of the original hyphenators. And my parents actually lobbied for the ERA in the 70s. So. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of that's where the Susan B. Anthony comes from.
And if you grow up not to be a feminist, you're really in trouble.
I know you got to change your name because this name, you know, it pretty much announces me.
It does. Okay. I want to ask you about, there's sort of an ebullience in your language and in the energy and tone, you know, of the lines of your poems. And yet it seems like there's a sting of loss right beneath the lines.
Mm-hmm.
And I could be wrong about this, but it almost seemed to enact the New Orleans that's in your one poem, you know, where the voice says, you know, don't show the hate, self-hate that holds the place together. And I don't know, is that accurate? Or?
Yeah, well, Jan, I think that's a really fantastic way to describe this. The sort of tone, I think, of this whole book. And Yeah, and I think it's a good way to characterize New Orleans itself. I mean, the way that I describe New Orleans to others is that it's a place that has really high highs and really low lows. That, you know, it's a place that is celebratory, but there's always that sort of sense of loss with it too, you know, with poverty and racism and all of the social problems that happen in the city. You know, there's racism, of course, that was highlighted with Hurricane Katrina and its aftermath. In a sense, you know, there's no denying that there is that sense of racism in New Orleans. In another context, though, New Orleans is a place where you get just some really amazing racial mixing, you know, with Creole culture, the way that the city is mapped out. You have, you know, a pocket that's predominantly white, a pocket that's predominantly black, rich, poor. So there's this, it's a really interesting place. I mean, yes, there are those prejudices that are evident. Also it's an amazing place where that sense of Creolism comes alive. Mm-hmm.
I know you have a new manuscript that you've just completed, and can you talk about that and how those poems are different or extensions of
sure.
what you're doing?
Yeah, the manuscript that I just finished a few weeks ago, is called Quiver, and it's about the science, mathematics, and evolution of beauty. And sort of in the process of writing this book, I realized that what I was really writing was love poems. Mm-hmm. And how we reconcile the sort of our belief in the hard fact of science and then our belief in love, and our connections with each other. So quite a few love poems. I mean, it coincided with actually the writing of this book also coincided with the first few years of my marriage. So there's a little bit of that as an undertone.
A lot of quiver.
Okay. Yes, a lot of quivering.
Okay.
But I'd like to read a poem or two from
the
new
be
poem.
Great.
This poem is called The Golden Lesson, and it's about Leonardo da Vinci. It's the scene is Leonardo da Vinci is sketching one of his famous anatomical sketches. And there is his apprentice shows up in this poem. He comes up under several names, but recently I should tell you it's been speculated that perhaps Leonardo da Vinci had a homosexual relationship with this apprentice. The Golden Lesson. Leonardo cracks the thief's sternum with precision and opens the body's proportion. Fearful symmetry glistening in the flat, wet lungs like a bird's folded wings or two lozenges of yellow amber laid on a plate. He licks his fingertips blackened by thin strips of coal as the cat suddenly and impolitely asks for its dinner. A body does not do as it is told. He is called Giacomo in, but the boy is rudely eating a wedge of pink melon in the kitchen. Sucking at it, in fact. So that his hands will stick with the fruit all night, and the pages of his books will bear stains and his boyish odor. The gray shade of evening falls over corpse and artist, as a candle flickers against the body's dark ruin. The neck corded with hard tendon to tether the shoulder's weight of brain and skull, and through it all, the windpipe ridged with cartilage climbing up like a soft ladder into the palate. The boy and his 17 years know nothing of this. The life dissected and sectioned out into a dark oval, which is the head, which leans back as if on a string tied to the throat, so that the throat opens into a white-stringed harp centering the imaginary line between halves of the body, the sketch nearly ready, but for the one criminal eye looking up to the artist from the table, removed from the patient with such desire like a child seeking a stray precious marble. Leonardo calls the boy Salai, which means demon. He pulls back the curtain to reprimand the malingering boy who now has anise candy on his breath. And although he knows Salai has stolen to have it, he does not comment because the licorice seed sweetens the room. The thief's hands cripple on the wood table, and the boy wonders what pleasure was held in this criminal wrist. Perhaps a thirst made its way into the body to play these strings, and the tongue and hand answered. Salai skims the corpse's dull skin with his finger, the body pinned down by the puckering O of the navel, his hand almost free of use to mention. The criminal eye does nothing but hold vigil in its rind of boiled egg white like a blue jewel encrusting a pale woman's ear. Perhaps the eye will study the artist as he draws the body. Perhaps inside the eye, an inverted picture of the two scholars will glint as they point and argue about man's divine proportion. And in their conversation will rise a sound from the thief like a harsh note forbidden in the box of a guitar. The imperfect soul made art from the Orphic instrument of muscle and calcium set ringing. Yes, in this room with the blackening window and the organ's sweet odor hotly releasing, the criminal will speak the feckless boy and his teacher like a dark chorus, and the indivisible golden cord will fly up. And who will hear this joy of the body? Who will play the harp in the boy?
Time for one more poem.
Okay, great. Sort of in that vein, I will read a poem called The Anthropology of Gold, which has some references to alchemy in the beginning. The Anthropology of Gold. Because the whole world is made of it. Because it is the world's first word written on a gilded scroll unfurling out of the lion's jaw. Its brief phrase is in us just as it is in this yellow animal playing the soft, rare bones of prey in his mouth. Gloria Mundi. Desire like a muscle cloud spilling out of the elk's staunch breast. This morning, I reach stone deep in the garden and think of the believing alchemist burying his rank vessel into the fire. For years, blindly expecting his wealth to appear, something from nothing. His ear foolishly pressed to the crucible, listening for the thin drawl of gold to rise from the bowl. And I, too, wish for it, this preciousness. And I, too, think to see it in the river's flash of afternoon riches, or in the marksman's bright arrow purring in its slot, or in the slanting light pouring through the pale orange skin of wild lilies. Today, for example, I find a bee alive and innocently dancing in the dog's mouth. To speak the rare code of this world, I will toil endlessly over its gifts, knowing it would yield such incongruous treasure, so that I could bite down hard, so that I could hold all my love for this world between my simple teeth.
The poetry of Susan B. Anthony Summers Willett, reading from her book entitled Rome. For more information about Rome or to learn about Susan's upcoming readings or events, www.susansw.com. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you so much, Jan. It's my pleasure.
That's great. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Joseph Wilk and Lauren Wolf. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody here on Independent Public Radio 91.3 WYEP.